In the dream, I was standing opposite my father in the middle of a big field, throwing a baseball back and forth. For a long time, we played in silence, enjoying the warmth of the afternoon and the rhythm of the game. Then I started asking questions about my life, mostly about my women's. Stupid shit. Like what he thought about Deborah's ashtray. Did he like what Jennifer wore a particular night we went out? Shit like that. As my arm tired, I asked if he knew that I'd gone to the Mayo Clinic and been diagnosed with MS. He caught the ball and threw it back. Suddenly, it seemed like a test. "How do you feel, son?" he asked. "Eh," I said with a shrug. "Sometimes better, sometimes a little worse." I threw the ball back and the game resumed. A while later, he interrupted the silence again. "How do you feel, son?" he asked. "Dad, if only I'd have known." But the future doesn't let you know it's there until it bites you in the ass, particularly, as I discovered, when it includes multiple sclerosis. Chronic, disabling, and hard to detect. The disease attacks the central nervous system, destroying the protective casing that surrounds nerve fibers. Although rarely fatal, it produces symptoms that range from loss of coordination and muscle strength to mood shifts and depression, with some bladder weakness, memory loss, spasms, and even paralysis thrown in for good measure. It was as if God had all this shit left over from the other afflictions he created and decided to throw it all into one disease. Kinda like a Saturday surprise. It was a motherfucker. It ate you up from the inside out. Instead of denial, I went into depression. By early 1988, I was hitting booze and pills pretty hard, spending a lot of time isolated in Hawaii. On a rare outing, I took Deborah on a shopping spree to New York. While holed up at the Plaza Athene, I snuck in a visit with Jennifer, who heard me ramble semi-coherently about life and death and left thinking I was suicidal. Though she never heard me reveal the reason why. In August, I returned to Gotham City to star in See No Evil, Hear No Evil, another lackluster comedy re-teaming me with Gene Wilder. My excuse was the money. I don't know what everybody else had in mind. Physically and emotionally, it was difficult to involve myself in the work. The picture also reunited me with Jennifer, who pestered me with questions about my distant, sullen, and markedly slower demeanor. "Why are you walking like an old man?" she asked. For weeks, I refused to answer. Why she didn't tire of such shit is testimony of our strange, twisted, and enduring love affair. Then one morning before I left for work, Jenny caught me unrolling my Coma de Garcon's shirt sleeve over a thin stream of blood as I exited the bathroom. I just shot up. "It's bunk," I said. "Why, Richard?" she asked. "Why are you fucking with this shit again?" The room was disturbingly silent for a long time before I was able to summon the courage to admit the last secret of my complicated life. But I don't think I could have said anything that would have shocked Jenny. We'd been through it all. "I went to the Mayo Clinic for some tests," I said. "I've been twice now. And? I have multiple sclerosis." "So that's the reason you're walking funny?" "Yeah." "And the bunk?" No reply. I had limits to what I thought needed explanations. I had my limits. Even in the early stages, the disease was unpredictable. It came without warning, like a relative showing up unannounced at my doorstep. I'd get up to walk across the room, and while my mind would picture me striding as always, I'd actually be splattered on the floor, a fucked-up tangle of surprised arms and legs. I had no control. I'd look up and say, "God, it's in your hands." I got a taste of things to come shortly after I moved from my longtime Northridge residence. It was more like fleeing the ghosts. into a two-story, Spanish-style house in Bel Air. Once I was walking up the long driveway when I lost control and fell down. Frightened, I called for help. The people who worked for me thought I was inside the house and ran up and down the stairs. About the time my fear turned into frustration, one of them finally poked her head out the front door and saw me waving like a castaway on a deserted island. "There you are," she exclaimed. "Right," I said, "but you don't get no prize because of it." It was like that, you know. At the end of 1988, I worked on Harlem Nights, Eddie Murphy's pet movie project. At the time, no one was bigger. Exercising his clout, he was the picture's writer, director, and star. He was trying to scale the same mountain that I climbed making JoJo. I should have warned the motherfucker. I never connected with Eddie. People talked about how my work had influenced Eddie, and perhaps it did. But I always thought Eddie's comedy was mean. I used to say, "Eddie, be a little nice," and that would piss him off. But Eddie can act. I don't care what people say. The motherfucker is a great actor. So throwing me and Eddie together after so much dreaming by agents and studio executives sounded exciting as hell. The potential had guys in Hollywood putting money down on new Porsches and vacation homes. Then Red Fox joined the mix and Eddie's movie took on the air of history. Three generations of black comics looked like the middle of the 1927 New York Yankees batting order. Only Harlem Nights wasn't a comedy, you know? It was Eddie's movie. That's what it was. I just wished that I'd been in peak form. For obvious reasons, I never felt obliged to inform anyone about the disease. But the fact was, the MS shit gave me a difficult time. It was my secret, and it put me in a dark place mood-wise through most of the movie. I finished thinking that Eddie didn't like me. It wasn't true. But thoughts don't care about truth and shit. They sit up in your mind and fuck with you whenever. "Hey, Rich." "What?" I didn't say anything. Of course, even paranoids have reason to be scared. In March 1990, after cleaning up at the Betty Ford Center, I treated myself to a long overdue deep sea fishing expedition in Australia. However, before I even had the chance to set off from my Brisbane hotel, I got sick. Like severe lethargy and shit. Chills, weakness, weird pain. Despite my objections, I really wanted to go fishing. The hotel doctor checked me into a local hospital, where other doctors hooked me up to all this shit and told me that I'd had a heart attack. "I'm glad you told me," I said. "Because I didn't know that. For real." "We'll want to keep you here for a month," they said. "You shouldn't travel so far so soon." "I thought the heart attack was a joke," I replied. "But what you said is really funny." I liked Australia, but if I was going to die, it was going to be in my own motherfucking house, you know? Following an emergency call, my personal physician arrived from L.A., put me through treadmill and electrocardiograph tests, and then accompanied me back home, explaining I'd incurred a mild infarction. Maybe, but the effects weren't mild. Afraid that I might die alone, without anyone around to love me, I remarried Flynn on April 1st. It wasn't hard. Flynn was there. She had my kids. She liked being married to me. Smart, Rich. How much did that foolish decision cost you? Can't remember? Does it matter anymore? No, because we divorced a few months later, and then I was just as alone as before, you know? But I didn't want to be dead without a wife. Honest. If I was going to die, I wanted a bitch there to cry. I never considered how much I could stand. No doubt the fire, the MS, and now the heart attack had caught up with me, though I didn't really acknowledge it until shortly before I partnered with Gene Wilder in Another You. One morning I woke up and tried getting out of bed, but my legs wouldn't move, not a fucking kick or twitch. Not only could I not stand, I couldn't even fall. And it fucked me up because I didn't feel bad, you know? I don't know what's wrong, I yelled at my doctor. It just won't work. Things like that happen, he said. It comes and goes. Some days might not be as bad. Other days can be worse. Rather than dwell on what could possibly be worse, I spent 2 intensely hard, exhausting, painful weeks learning how to walk again. By the time the cameras rolled, I was on my feet, fragile, wobbly, and obviously not in fighting shape. But I was on my feet. It took regular cortisone shots and steroid treatments from my doctor to keep me going, but I was determined to finish the picture. Yet toward the end, even that seemed iffy. The picture, which was strife-ridden after a change of directors, ran about 800 weeks over schedule. By that time, I was exhausted. I never had a conversation with Gene or anyone about my struggle with MS, but it was pretty clear my body was mostly beyond my control. They started keeping a wheelchair on the set. Finally, my stuff said, I put up with you this long. But no more, motherfucker. Gene and I were doing a scene in which we went hunting, and I was supposed to kill him after a run-in with a great big bear. They used a real live bear, who was trained, but a big motherfucker nonetheless, with claws and teeth. He stood behind Gene, and before I fired at Gene, I was supposed to talk shit to the bear. Now, I don't know if the bear knew he frightened people, but he scared the shit out of me. If he acted up, I couldn't run. I was dinner, you know. Even worse, when the director yelled action, I didn't move so hot. I tried hobbling around a bit, but my legs weren't operating like my brain was telling them to. Finally, the director must have overheard me arguing with myself. Run, Rich, run! No, motherfucker, just shut the fuck up. Realizing Richard couldn't move, he came over and in a private whisper asked if I would be more comfortable having a stuntman substitute for me. Momentarily relieved, I said, yes, that would be fine. But then the reality hit me. The only comparison that comes to mind is when New York Yankee great Lou Gehrig was taken out of the game. Only there was no ceremony. I didn't have a stadium full of people cheering for me. Just a film set with a lot of folks anxious to get on with their work. Yet that was the beginning of me not being able to do the shit anymore. Whether I wanted to admit it or not, the MS took over. 32. One morning at the end of May 1991, I pleaded with Deborah to let me stay in bed and skip my scheduled doctor's appointment. At the time, she worked as my personal assistant. With our history of heartbreak, that was less a job than an excuse to be together rather than alone. She knew that I loved her dearly, even though I'd been a perfect asshole in the past. Ornery, depressed, and weakened by a general malaise that had turned my body into a lead weight, I begged and begged to be left by myself, propped up in bed, smoking, and staring at the television as if it was a volume. Ordinarily, I got my way acting like a child. But that day, Debbie didn't buy my shit. You don't look so good, Richie, she kept saying. I really think you need to go. Both of us knew how much I hated going to the hospital, even when it was for a routine checkup. But I have a suspicion that sometimes I get together with women for a reason other than just the quest of pussy. Though they mostly behave like bitches, they can also be like angels who watch out for Richard. Okay, I'll go, I said finally. Only if you stay with me. A few hours later, the doctor saw a funny blip on my EKG and checked me into the hospital for observation. If I'd been observing some foxy nurses sucking my dick, it might have been all right. But about 4 in the morning, I was awakened by a sharp, horrible pain that made my body contort and writhe as if someone was trying to pull my nipple through my asshole. Then the shit all centralized in my heart, and I knew what was going down. Richard, Who's that? God. Go away, motherfucker. Let's wrap it up. But I got more material. The hallway flew by. Lights on the ceiling looked like steps leading to heaven, I hoped, or perhaps a Michael Jackson video. People rushed around me. Doctors hurried to explain the what's and how's of a quadruple bypass operation. I asked Debbie to sign papers that would prevent the vultures from eating up all the money. But there was no time. That was the biggest impression I had. Everything was moving fast. Was I scared? Scared of dying? Shit, I don't know. A nurse sticking a giant needle into my arm. Another, she explained, was going into my heart. Okay, you know, I wasn't there to argue. But whatever drug they give you before an operation, you don't have to worry. It takes away all your pain and fears. One minute I was dying. The next I imagined that Sammy Davis Jr. was in the room, snapping his fingers and doing Sammy shit while Frank Sinatra sang a classic. Comedian Jan Murray stood in the hallway, not wanting my life to turn into a fucking lounge act. I told Sammy to go and get Frank. I wanted him to help me get back in the main showroom. I mean, if not Frank, then who? Okay, bub, Sammy said. I'll get him. Groggy, confused, dulled, and numbed by drugs, I came out of the operation believing that some kind doctors and nurses had gotten together and arranged for my hospital bed to be placed in the middle of a blue trout stream. When my eyes opened, I was gazing out on a beautiful scene in the woods instead of a cold and stark hospital room loaded with heart monitoring equipment. I worked my fishing rod with as much ease as ever, getting some bites, but never the big one. The nurse who wandered in struck me as a nun. She was Sister Rosie, and I spoke with an Irish accent. Sister Rosie, don't stand in the trout stream, I warned. The same thing happened when the shift changed and a guy nurse wandered in checking shit. I thought he was an Irish priest and told him to get on out of the trout stream. He looked at me as if I should have known better. The Bulls are going to win, he said. I didn't understand at first, but then something must have fused together in my brain, like a missing piece of railroad track, because suddenly I realized that I was in the hospital and that he was talking about the basketball playoffs. You mean the Bulls are going to beat the Lakers? I asked. Quick cut. I bet him $30 the Lakers would win. L.A. beat the shit out of Chicago. It was the only game they won the entire series. I was happy, man. But the motherfucker never came into my room again. To this day, I've yet to be paid. At least I was around to collect, you know. I'd entered the hospital for a routine checkup, but left with my heart having been removed, flipped over, and attached to new veins that had been relocated from around my legs and ankles. A long Frankenstein scar ran down the center of my chest like a receipt from the grocery store. I'd been prepared to die. Expected it. But then I realized, God chooses the checkout time. Hey, Rich. I changed my mind, he said. You were right. You do have some more material. Get your ass back out there. Just don't smoke, my doctor said as I left. I'd already gone through a pack of Marlboros in the hospital. What about the pussy? I asked. Why not? He answered. That's what I said, too. Why not? Why the fuck not? 33. Enough was enough. In September, I decided to take my battle with MS public. The nudge came when producer George Slatter asked if he could organize a special CBS tribute to me, and I agreed. The show brought together Arsenio Hall, Eddie Murphy, Patti LaBelle, and dozens of friends and performers in an emotional look at my entire career. Until then, MS had been a private matter. My problem. I was too proud to want to be seen as debilitated. nor did I want sympathy, nor did I want to discuss any of the shit. I had more than enough problems trying to figure out why the fuck God had decided to give me MS. I asked the question daily, sometimes hourly. It echoed in my head like a fucking church bell. Why me? Why did you give this shit to me? But there were no answers. So either I could drive myself crazy, which wouldn't have been too long a trip, or I could, as had been my practice since my first misstep in dog poo, milk the entertainment value, sail down the uncharted river of my life, and check out where in the hell the current took me. After all, I told myself, fuck it, you know. This is my life. I've got MS, not death. Some people found reason to joke otherwise. George had put on a similar event for Sammy Davis Jr. not long before he passed away. The irony prompted Eddie Murphy, the show's MC, to wonder how scared I was when George called. Going into the Beverly Hilton Hotel that evening, I worried how people would react when they saw that I needed a cane to stand, that I had trouble walking, speaking, and even doing little things like eating. But at the end of the evening, I was relieved to finally put all the rumors to rest. No more hiding, pretending, or shit. My bruised pride was mighty grateful. But it didn't make coping with MS any easier. Each day it seemed I was forced to confront the disease. It was like being held captive by a truly nasty motherfucker. One day I would be able to get around using a cane. The next day I wouldn't have the strength to even hobble, and would have to use my motorized cart or Moby, as I called it. I spilled drinks, had difficulty eating, and even more frightening, I once fell in the shower. Although impossible to cure, I fought the MS by devoting part of every day to some kind of treatment. In addition to the cortisone injections and intravenous steroids that I'd been taking for nearly 2 years, I saw a therapist, took antidepressants for my mood swings, and worked with physical therapists. I also watched my diet and alcohol consumption. My doctor said, "You're doing great. You could go on like this for a long, long time." "Is that a reward?" I asked. Considering the alternative, I supposed it was. But even my best efforts only slowed the degenerative disease. That's when I unbaffled this baffling disease. Saw the big picture. Saw it as clear as the first day I got cable TV. It was a message from God. "Hey, Rich, you ever heard the phrase delayed gratification?" "Yeah?" "Good, 'cause you've done had a lot of gratification." "So? Well, now comes the delay." In some ways, it was more like a total stoppage. Despite 2 Rolls Royces and a Ferrari parked in the garage, I couldn't drive a car anymore. I couldn't climb stairs. I couldn't even have an orgasm. But my dick would get hard, you know. Rise to the occasion. "Visit me like a friend or something. Hey, Rich, how you doing, brother? Just wanted to say hi." The motherfucker always caught me off guard.
"Come again?" I asked. "Shit, motherfucker. I ain't even come a first time."
That's what it all boils down to, right? Can you or can't you? I tried, Mama, I tried. There were times when my dick got hard and I got so excited that I called people just to tell them about it. The people I called weren't always women's, you know. It was whoever answered the phone. "Hey, Herbie, guess what? My dick's hard and it's looking at me." I never prayed in my life. But MS made me pray. I'd be in bed with a woman and I'd start praying. "Please, God, I know you're an extremely busy man, but if you could find it in your heart to grant me a tiny little favor, not world peace, not a cure for MS, no miracles, man. I just need my prick heart, okay?" Eventually, I realized that I should deal with the basics rather than the luxury items, like my bladder. Before MS, I dialogued with my bladder, you know. Like I'd have to piss, but I wouldn't be near a toilet. So I'd ask my bladder, "Hey, there's not a bathroom nearby. You think you can wait till home? Only 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, no problem, Rich.
But MS ended all communication. I'd be on the street talking with some women's, and suddenly I start pissing. Feel piss streaming down my legs, squirming into my socks, and landing in my boots. It was no different than the other problems I had with, say, my legs. You know, I'd want to walk across the room, but they wouldn't go. Then the women's, they said, "Don't worry, it's all right." Clearly, though, it's not all right. I don't like to see nobody piss. So why is it okay for people to watch me piss? And in the middle of the street. But people always say shit like that is okay so long as it isn't them. Once all the shit ganged up on me at the same time. I was on the freeway being driven back from someplace, and I was feeling cocky. Somewhere up ahead, a truck jackknifed, causing a monstrous traffic jam. It seemed every car in the world was on the freeway that day. Cars from as far away as Denver came just to clog up the damn road. As we sat, I saw one of the prettiest bitches I'd ever seen in my life, and she was waving at me. I waved back, and the bitch opened her car door, got out, and walked across the freeway to meet me. She kept waving as she weaved a path through the cars, cute little friendly waves that told me she thought I was cute. Suddenly my arms started twitching and doing shit, some wild shit. And I tried to get my arm down, but it wouldn't go. Come on, arm, quit that shit.
No.
Please.
No.
Just as she got to the car, my bladder decided it was time to go too. The floodgates opened. The tender of the pump house yelled, "Now!" And I prayed I didn't slide off the seat. She said something about how it was so funny, but I could stop waving, you know? I didn't bother to explain. I couldn't. I was too preoccupied, because while my brain thought about how much I wanted to fuck her, my dick was saying, "Go ahead and try." I did what I could. One night I came home and pissed outside because I couldn't get to the door. Right in the flowers. I thought that was okay. In fact, I was grateful to have made it that far and been able to get my dick out. But you know what? The dog was pissed off. He ran across the yard snarling.
"Rich man, that's my spot. I've been pissing on that geranium for 2 years. What the hell are you doing?"
I had to go.
"But that's my geranium. There's a whole yard here."
I gave that damn dog an abbreviated look. ASPCA.
"Shut up, motherfucker," I said. "I may not be able to kick your ass anymore, but I still got my gun."
By the fall of 1992, I was resigned to a life in the slow lane, and hopefully few surprises. If I went crazy, it was with my remote control, flipping through 120 channels with the speed I used to drive. But then one day I got my ass kicked. The phone rang. My assistant told me that my accountant was on the line. And he was very worried. "He says that he heard you were dead."
"Tell him that I was," I said, "but I came back to check the books."
Rumors of my death spread as far as New York newspapers. It's a bitch to be watching the nightly news and see the motherfuckers talking about you in the past tense. Friends called. The weirdest shit was when people who worked for me started to believe that I could go at any time. Like my housekeeper. She'd walk into the bedroom while I was sleeping and start making a lot of noise. When I didn't stir, she squeezed my toe.
"Oh, shit, what are you doing?"
I screamed, waking up in a panic of discomfort.
"Sorry, sorry, Mr. Pryor, but I thought you were maybe, well, maybe you were no longer living."
"Why the hell would you think that?
You were lying on the bed with your eyes closed, not hardly moving. That's how I sleep. How do you do it?"
"But the news on the TV in the kitchen, I heard you died."
Well, they were lying. There were probably countless ways I could have dispelled the reports of my premature demise, but the one I chose certainly wasn't the easiest. On October 31st, after weeks of working out new material at the Comedy Store, I performed before a sold-out audience at the Circle Star Theater outside San Francisco, my first concert in nearly 6 years. Didn't matter how many times I'd done this before. I was scared, man. I truly was. First of all, they call it stand-up comedy, but I found myself having to adapt the format with a big easy chair placed in the center of the stage. Swallowing more fear than I'd known my entire life, I gingerly made my way across the stage with the assistance of a silver-handled cane. Then I sat down. It wasn't easy. The crowd thought they were there to laugh, but my physical condition also gave them some major drama. Gave me some, too, you know? Afterward, I thought I had kicked ass. The reviews were mostly in agreement. Encouraged, I hit the road. Although it wasn't anywhere near the same as it had been in the past, none of the drug-induced craziness, the spur-of-the-moment insanity with women's, the outpouring of love I felt was overly generous. But after a few gigs, I realized that I had more heart than energy, more courage than strength. Just turning in a decent 40 minutes exhausted me way too much. The mind was willing, but my feet couldn't carry me to the end zone. Knowing I was unable to continue through the early months of 1993, I canceled the rest of the tour. What a bitch, you know. It destroyed me emotionally. All the shit that I wanted to say was in my head, with nowhere to go. I could hear the applause. I imagined the rejuvenating effect of laughter. There was nothing like it in the world. 34. I had my first encounter with death when I was a kid visiting my grandfather's farm in Springfield. One night he took me for a walk. On the property next door, we came across a dead cow. Enormous motherfucker lying on its side. For a moment, we thought it was asleep, but it was dead. No question. Don't know why, but my grandfather handed me a gunny sack and instructed me to kneel down and open it up by the cow's asshole. Then he kicked the cow in the belly. A second later, a possum ran out of the cow's ass, straight into the gunny sack I held. "Hold the sack, boy!" my grandfather yelled. "Holy shit, Pop!" I exclaimed. "You know, it was a fucking possum come out of that cow's asshole." In any case, my grandfather grabbed the bag out of my hands and swung it over his shoulder, holding it there, despite the possum squirming, until we came to a big rock. Then he slammed it against the rock, killing the possum. Okay. Then I started wondering what we were going to do with that dead rodent. You know what we did with it? We took it home and my grandma cooked it. We ate the motherfucker. To this day, I don't eat anything with barbecue sauce because I had to drown the motherfucker in that shit in order to get it into my stomach. But it taught me about death, all right. Life is all there is. When you kick, that's about it. Show's over. I'm sorry whatever others may think, but ain't shit happening when you're dead. A friend once said to me, "Life's a bitch, then you die, and you don't get change." You don't get change. You know, that's the truth. The shit they do to people in the funeral parlor getting you ready for the funeral, if you don't wake up from that, you have to know that being dead means that you are dead. Fade to black, you know? When my body shuffles off to Buffalo, I want to be cremated. I don't want nobody fucking with me again, because there are people who like to fuck with dead people, twist their toes around and shit. I don't want nobody fucking with my toes or my nuts. On the off chance that I'm wrong about death, I want to make sure that I can still fuck. If there's pussy in heaven, I'll be chasing it. Imagine that. Chasing pussy for eternity. Sounds an awful lot like life, doesn't it? Although death has occupied a lot of my idle thoughts the past few years, I look at it like a report of bad weather. Dark and stormy clouds today. Maybe clearing up later in the week. The truth is, has been, and near as I can figure, will continue to be until the last gasp, that MS may have kicked my ass into the blackness, but I have too much to live for to give up on basking in the light again. Throughout the illness, the women in my life have made sure of that. I hear from my first wife, Pat, from Shelley and Maxine. Geraldine's picture rests on my bedroom table. Flynn comes by, reminding me to exercise. Deborah, who's remained so understanding, has never left the spot closest to my heart. And Jennifer, bless her lovely soul, kicks my ass from treatment to treatment and makes sure I get a dose of laughter every day. Then there are my children. Somehow they've managed to make it in life and turn out magnificently. Richard Jr. continues to keep the prior name alive in Peoria, while Rain continues to prove herself in Hollywood. Elizabeth is in graduate school, and Steve and Kelsey and Franklin have their work cut out just trying to grow up in this world. At this stage of my life, I'm more amazed by their presence than ever. When I look at them, I see so much. I see all my debauchery, but I also see the goodness and the long road of hope and possibility ahead of them. It makes me love them very much. Do I have regrets? I think about what might have happened if I'd done things differently. But I can't go back and redo them. So why, you know? What is, is. I'm glad I'm in show business. As crazy as it sounds, I don't think there are any people like us on Earth. I plan on doing more work, acting, writing, producing. The ideas swirl in my head. I'm also proud of the work that I've already done. I'm glad I was alive at a time in history when it was possible to record what I had to say. Because I think I had something to say. It sounds presumptuous, maybe, a guy from the whorehouses in Peoria. But why not? I came with perspective. Looking up. Looking out. The view was clear. People are nice to each other, and they're also mean to each other. That's the way it's always been and probably always will be. The fact that we're different colors is basically just an excuse for doing all that shit. But if people understand the differences a little better, learn to blend the colors, which was my job as a comedian, it's possible to see we're all the same. Same needs and wants. A little money, a little wine, a little pussy. Lately, I've been thinking about something. Back when I was in the army stationed in Germany, I was in charge of repairing utilities. I was always on the phone calling different offices. One day, I picked up the phone and started talking to this lady who had a nice voice that intrigued me. A short time later, I got to meet her, and she turned out to be one of the nicest ladies I'd ever met. Although she was married, we used to make love all the time. Mornings, afternoons, nights. Her husband eventually found out. He knew she liked me, but for some reason he didn't bother as long as I kept away while he was there. Shortly before I shipped back home, we made love one more time, and afterwards she said, "I will come and visit you in Peoria." Sure. That's what I thought anyway. Then one day, long after I'd been back to Peoria, I was in a bar and who came in? This lady. She looked wonderful. No different. But I wasn't the same soldier, you know, and it panicked me. I knew she couldn't withstand all the shit in my life. So while her husband waited, I made love with her one more time at the Holiday Inn, and then we said our goodbyes, and that was it, the last time we saw each other. That's been in my mind lately. Why, Rich? Well, I've been thinking about where both of us were at that moment in our lives. The future was so unclear, not bright or dark, just the future, and our hearts were so strong. I hope that she's all right. I really do. I hope that she found whatever she was looking for. Life can seem so complicated at times, yet when you look back, what is it besides the accumulation of such encounters with people? You never know. As for me, I's amazed that I didn't OD on heroin, get stuffed with coke, or die from AIDS. I think it's remarkable that I'm still here, thinking these silly thoughts. Some people have said it's pure luck. Others say it's testimony to the human spirit. I think it has more to do with something else. Through an old friend of mine, I once said, "There ain't but two pieces of pussy you're gonna get in your life. That's your first and your last. And all that shit in between don't matter. That's just the extra gravy. But you never forget your first. And you damn sure won't forget your last. And if you live that long, you're in big trouble. I'd rather die of cancer than fuck around and remember my last piece of pussy, you know. I got some this morning, and right now, that's as far back as I want to remember. Oh, yeah. One more thing. I always remember to keep some sunshine on my face." This has been a High Bridge production, read by J.D. Jackson. Copyright 2018 by Indigo Inc. Published by arrangement with Rare Bird Books. Recording copyright 2018 by High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.